Rights delayed sums up the argument in a way in that the right to organize, or the right to choose your own union, was delayed so long that it was denied.
We gonna roll, we gonna roll, we gonna roll a union on.
Today on Arts and Letters, we'll be talking with historian Charles W. Romney about his book, Rights Delayed, The American State and the Defeat of Progressive Unions, 1935 to 1950.
Progressive unions were ones that were working for a little bit more of a social agenda. Inside the workplace, a little more workplace democracy. Workers have more say in the running of the union, in the running of the plant.
Progressive unions, West Coast canneries, and historian Charles W. Romney on Arts and Letters.
We're gonna roll the union on. We're gonna roll the union on. If the boss is in the way, we're gonna roll it over him.
From the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and welcome to Arts and Letters, a program providing opportunities for the celebration of the arts and humanities. Today, we'll be talking with historian Charles W. Romney about his book, Rights Delayed, The American State and the Defeat of Progressive Unions, 1935 to 1950.
Progressive unions flourished in the 1930s by working alongside federal agencies created during the New Deal. Yet in 1950, few progressive unions remained. Why?
We'll be taking up that question, and we'll discuss how anti-communism and congressional conservatism intensified the main reason for progressive unions' decline, which was the New Deal state's focus on legal procedure.
In this book, I argue that anti-communism and congressional conservatism really intensified the main reason for the decline of progressive unions, the New Deal state's focus on legal procedure.
Let's learn about progressive unions through the lens of the West Coast canning industry with Charles W. Romney on Arts and Letters. Charles Romney, history professor, historian of labor law, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Labor rights and progressive rights are important to you.
That's right. That's right.
Why are they important to you?
I definitely think that workers at any workplace have the right to choose their own union. So in some ways, I think that's an important aspect to any workplace. But growing up as I did, as a lot of lawyers around, and I was often on the dock with no appeal possible for some minor infraction, was struggling to come up with some legal language that would get myself out of trouble. But there are a lot of cases in American history where you have a law passed, or there's a right that is extended: the right to vote, the right to organize, the right to do many things. And in the United States, many times, that right is codified in a statute, in a law, but then practically it's worked out in the courts,
right?
Or in a political process that involves the courts or a regulatory agency like the National Labor Relations Board. And so I think that's partly when I really started investigating and get into this material. I saw, and there's a lot of echoing of the language of the right to choose your own union that is kind of throughout, but it gets embedded in this very dense system of law. And you're trying all, and there's a bunch of different agents, people trying to work it out. And a lot of them are well-intentioned. Yeah. Many of them are not well-intentioned. Yeah. But they're all trying to struggle to fight locally to enact this national law or to sort of win what they think are their rights. And it becomes a web of legal procedure, legal language that makes it difficult sometimes for that right to be grasped by the people who it's supposed to get, the workers.
So let's just define some terms first. And this is a little academic, but what the heck? I think we should define some terms because we're going to go back to many of these terms.
Okay.
So for those folks who don't know all that much about the American state and the defeat of progressive unions, 1935 to 1950, which would include, I think, most of us, What is a pledge card?
A pledge card, if you're in a workplace and you are part of a group of workers and a union comes in, or you decide you want to form your own union, in labor law since the 1930s, you would sign a card that says you support a particular union. So let's say it's the Food, Tobacco, and Agricultural Workers or the Teamsters. You would sign a card, and it's kind of an official card that has the insignia of the union on it, and you would sign it and say, I pledge my support for this union at this job.
The union is behind us, we shall not be moved. The union is behind us, we shall not be moved. Just like a tree that's standing by the water, we shall not be moved.
The union then collects those cards and they present them to the government and say, hey, look, we have this many people who support us in this workplace.
We will stand and fight together. We shall not be moved, just like a tree that's standing by the water. We shall not be moved.
Once a group of workers vote, majority, 51% or over, for a union, then traditionally in labor law, that means the entire workforce of that unit, covered by the contract or the collective bargaining agreement, is member of the union, potentially, and is covered by that union contract. And so you can imagine a situation where you have 51% of the workers in a workplace vote for a union, but 49% did not. They're going to end up members of that union, and they're going to get the benefits of that collective bargaining contract. So it's a controversy whether they should pay union dues and be members of the union, because they're getting all the benefits of the contract.
We are black and white together. We shall not be moved. We are black and white together. We shall not be moved, just like our...
So it's an interesting issue. Getting the benefits, and do you have to pay the dues?
Right.
We shall not be moved.
All right. Secondly, Wagner Act.
Yeah. So the Wagner Act was part of the New Deal. So Franklin Delano Roosevelt came into the presidency in the 1930s and 1933, and he had a series of reforms or laws to try to deal with the crisis of the Depression and the economic downturn. One of the laws that was passed in his time was the Wagner Act, named after Robert Wagner, who was a senator from New York. And that law, there was a sort of a precursor to it in the National Recovery Administration, where there was a section that allowed unions to form and collectively bargain. But the Wagner Act, among other things, allowed workers to choose their own union. And it set up this agency, the National Labor Relations Board, to enforce that law. So the law was passed. There was a lot of struggle within the National Labor Relations Board, within the government, within the workplace, with a lot of attorneys trying to enact or figure out exactly what the Wagner Act meant in practice. But the law itself gave the right to workers to choose their own union. So instead of having a union organized directly with the employer or not having any union, they were allowed to choose a union to represent them.
We shall not be moved.
Closed shop.
Closed shop's a very complicated term. In my period, closed shop meant many different things. As a historian, you'd have to say, what place and time are you asking about before you say closed shop? Yes, so the time and place on the Pacific Coast in the 1930s and 40s, in the period that I have studied extensively, the closed shop meant something a little bit different, and that if you were trying to sign up for a cannery, so a food processing plant, and you wanted to work canning sardines in Monterey in 1943 or 47, you would need to be a member of this union, whatever union represented that sardine facility. And so you would need to be a member of the Teamsters. What happened is that a lot of times workers would apply to be an employee, and there would be a list of people who were already a member of the Teamsters or another union and already a member of a different union, the union we talk about, and we're going to talk about later today, Local 78, represented lettuce packers, for example, all across the West Coast. So there were lists, and they would turn into potentially blacklists. So if a union already had a contract with a particular plant or a shed, a packing shed, the workers would already have to belong to the union. If they belonged to the other's union in a fight, then they would be denied the ability to join that workplace.
This is Arts and Letters. We're listening to Charles W. Romney talk about the American state and the defeat of progressive unions, 1935 to 1950. We'll be back in a moment. I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and this is Arts and Letters. Let's return to historian Charles W. Romney and our discussion about his book, Rights Delayed, The American State and the Defeat of Progressive Unions, 1935 to 1950. All right, so let's just talk a little bit about this book, amazingly detailed. What I found so interesting is that it seems much of the crux of it early on was about whether folks who worked for agriculture actually worked for industry.
Come all of you good workers, good news to you I'll tell of how the good old union has come in here to dwell.
And there seemed to be a real division. And particularly with folks who were working in agricultural areas, they were often migrant workers or workers who were very seasonal. And could they be represented by a union? Yes. But under which union? And there were two major groups then, right? The AFL and the CIO. Could you kind of help us disentangle the idea of the agricultural versus the industry debate? Because to me, that seemed to be at the center of the problems in 1935.
Yes. So the Wagner Act, for various political reasons, excluded agricultural labor from its protections. So if you were in an industry that was obviously industrial, and these definitions, of course, are not handed down from on high, they are debated and fought over within law and politics.
Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
So agricultural workers were excluded. And at the start in 1935 and in the years afterwards, the agricultural industry on the West Coast in California and in Oregon and Washington and Arizona, it was unclear whether the people who picked, let's say, citrus, we'll talk about oranges, talk about oranges later. Let's say you're in the orange groves and you're picking an orange. Is that agricultural? Probably. But once that orange is picked and put in a crate,
it's processed.
Someone's got to box it up. Or someone has to, if they're going to have a canned orange, they're going to can it. Or vegetables usually canned, oranges are usually packed. So what happens when it goes into a physical structure, a building? This would be a packing shed, and it's packed. And so is that agricultural or is that industrial? And no one knew. So the National Labor Relations Board, the agency that was created to enact the Wagner Act and to let workers choose their own union, decided that the people in the packing sheds were industrial, and so they were covered by the Wagner Act.
And this would have been 1935,
36, 37, 38. Employers of those packing sheds decided
were not happy
about it. Yeah, they said it was agricultural. And so in American politics and law, when you disagree, you go to court.
Yeah.
So the National Labor Relations Board and its lawyers fought a series of court battles with the employer attorneys, and they fought to see whether the courts would rule that these packing sheds are industrial or agricultural. And it wasn't just oranges. There were fish packing sheds up and down the coast, vegetables, fruits, nuts. So all these kind of food areas, when the food is harvested, whether it's in the field or in the ocean, the courts generally saw that potentially as agricultural, depending on the industry. But when it's packed, the courts ultimately ruled that these were industrial and so covered by the National Labor Relations
Act. Okay.
Oh, workers, can you stand it? Oh, tell me how you can. Will you be a lousy scab or will you be a man? Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
So just to back up a little bit, these are Pacific states, Arizona, California, Oregon, Washington State. And the idea here was, could folks who were in an agricultural-based industry choose their own union?
Yes, that's right. That's a good way to put it. Agricultural-based industry, that's a good way to put it. So would they be able to have the government, in this case the National Labor Relations Board, work on their behalf to let those employees choose their own unions? So the union we're going to talk about, the Progressive Union, I focus on the United Cannery Workers, often called its acronym UCAPAWA, other times called the United, later called the Food, Tobacco, and Agriculture Union, the FTA. It's the same group of folks. The UCAPAWA is a member of the CIO.
Right.
They split off at a certain point from the AFL. Those folks started out organizing agricultural workers in the fields. And they had a wing up until 1939, 1940, 1941 that was based in farms and other agricultural areas. Then, after the Wagner Act, they kind of expanded and decided to also organize potentially the same group of workers or workers that migrated, but not exactly the same group of workers, but the people who packed that food.
Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
And so then, because of the Wagner Act and because the National Labor Relations Board was able to get those food packing plants inside the protections of the Wagner Act, they focused ultimately on those areas, or those industries that they could get collective bargaining through the government.
Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Cause poor folks haven't got a chance unless we organize.
And although this is historical and so well detailed, one cannot help feel for these migrant workers because, one, at least there are lots of incidents where they're treated abominably. I mean, just absolutely horribly. And they have no recourse. And if they're not under the union, then they have no benefits for legal representation. But the problem with that is that the NLRB is so detailed in what they need to do in order to win any of these cases that they sometimes go as long as 3 or 4 years after. And these are migrant and seasonal workers, so they've moved on.
Exactly. So that was a real problem for the unions and for the workers and for the agency, the National Labor Relations Board. You're exactly right. A seasonal industry, if you think of a classic industry, auto production in Detroit, it goes 52 weeks a year. There's a single place that it's at. The workers tend to be the same people. You can have a unionization drive that really doesn't matter if it's winter, summer, spring. It's just going to go on. If you have a seasonal industry like food packing, then it's only a couple months. You're only going to have the oranges at a certain period of time. The lettuce is only coming out of the fields a certain period of time. And the workers tend to migrate to different areas depending on the pack, it's called, depending on the season of the fruit and the vegetable and the food. And even within an industry like lettuce, you would go from Salinas to Porterville down to Arizona and the Salt River District, potentially down the Imperial Valley. So you could migrate, even if you're sticking with lettuce, to a whole bunch of different areas. So you're right on the problem there is that if you have a short packing season, 8 weeks, 9 weeks, and you have a long legal process, by the time the packing season is over, there's still no contract, they're still fighting, you have to wait till next year.
The workers on the SB line for strikes are out of call, but Casey Jones, the engineer, he wouldn't strike at all. His boiler, it was leaking, and the drivers on the bum, and the engines and the bear, and they were all out of plumb.
And then the next year, and then the
That's
next
right.
year.
Casey Jones kept his junk pile running.
Casey Jones
was working double time.
Casey Jones
got a wooden medal for being good and faithful on the SB line.
So employers were using that in the early days of these unions in the food processing industry. They would just delay. They would file an appeal. They would ask for a little bit more time to file their brief. And by that time, the workers were gone. So the board, being the National Labor Relations Board, and their attorneys really struggled to find out how to let workers choose their own union when they migrated from plant to plant, from pack to pack, from fruit to vegetable, and they were in different places. So they really struggled to find a fast way to let them have a contract, if they so desired, in time for that packing season in a particular area.
The worker said to Casey, won't you help us win this strike? But Casey said, let me alone, you'd better take a hike. Well, Casey's wheezy engine ran right off the wheezy track, and Casey hit the river with an awful smack.
I mean, you talk about some absolutely brutal stories. Could you talk about perhaps one or two of the cases that came up during that time where these people were just treated terribly and they had so little recourse? It was nice that they had some protections from the NLRB, but can you think of a case?
Definitely. There's quite a few cases in 1935 and 1936 in Salinas, in Watsonville area, where there were people packing fruits, strawberries and different fruits. And this was in the early days of the National Labor Relations Act. And so the employers were still fighting and resisting any regulation by the government. But the police were hired privately by those lettuce employers, the strawberry employers, and the police were very brutal and just beat violently with sticks and other tools the workers who were trying to organize. The National Labor Relations Board case on that fight in Salinas said the record shows a degree of sadism. And this was a fight, again, against workers trying to unionize. Right. And there was a great fear of unions.
Casey Jones, hit the river bottom. Casey Jones, broke his blooming spine. Casey Jones, turned into an angel. He got a trip to heaven on the SP line.
And of course, this is the quintessential question, I think. It's just hard to understand how working people are not uniting, they're fighting each other. And not only are they fighting each other, the separate unions, the AFL and the CIO, are fighting each other ideologically, even though they have many of the same values.
Yeah, it's a good question. It's a perennial issue for historians who study the American working class. But yeah, there were a lot of divisions in the 1930s and 40s within the labor movement, outside the labor movement, within different workplaces about if you're going to form a union, what kind of union do you want to form? What should the union stand for? What should it support? Should right. it only be focused on higher wages? Should it have a more political agenda to try to make the entire society better? And so that was a very difficult debate for workers, for people who supported workers, for the labor movement, for labor lawyers, for everybody to try to decide. And the Pacific Coast canning industry, as we call it, the canneries, food processing on the West Coast, had even more diversity, I think, than many other industries because these plants were small. They were distributed across the Pacific Coast. And so you could have a group of workers kind of figure out their own ideas and ideology in isolation in some ways from the rest of the people on the Pacific Coast who are doing the same thing. So you'd have a lot more diversity of what should be done within that particular industry. And the different unions that tried to organize these workers varied greatly from the American Federation of Labor, the START, who had a system of allowing these unions to form. The AFL, the American Federation of Labor, had what are called federal unions, these independent unions. That means they didn't have an international organization of their own, but they were sort of organized directly by the central office in Washington, D.C.
And what was the AFL's philosophy in 35?
They were sort of all over the place, but within the canning industry, the American Federation of Labor was seen to be more willing to work with employers. So a lot of times, some American Federation of Local Unions would sort of work directly with the employer at the start. And we'll talk a little bit about the California case with a gentleman named Vandeleer, who would just organize employers, really never talk to the workers. So the workers would show up one day and they'd be told they're a member of the AFL. They'd be given a card and they'd say, okay, that's great. Here's your new shop steward for the union.
You're listening to Arts and Letters. Let's learn about Edward Vandeleer and his manner and methods for organizing unions.
Edward Vandeleer was the head of the California American Federation of Labor, so the California section of the AFL. And he was given a lot of autonomy by the president at that time of the American Federation of Labor, William Green. And so Vandeleer ran a lot of these unions. And when food processing started to become a possibility for unionization after the Wagner Act, Vandeleer decided that he wanted to organize these workers. So he didn't talk to the employees at these packing sheds. He went directly to the employers and said, hey, why don't you sign a contract with us and we will represent you.
And we'll make sure these folks are signed up.
We'll make sure they're signed up, but we'll also make sure they don't join that dangerous other union right. That you don't want to deal with, which would have been Unicapawa.
Right. So deal with me.
Deal with me. And so these were sort of organizing employers in a way rather than organizing the workers. Although there's a lot of negative things to say about Vandeleer, certainly. But in some plants, you want to be fair a little bit,
sure.
workers didn't have the time or the energy or anything else to organize a collective bargaining agreement or get a contract to get wages or to get their overtime pay done. And so all of a sudden you show up and you're a member of the American Federation of Labor and you get some representation. That could be a good thing.
Right, sure. And before they had nothing, so
before
it's
they
something.
Had nothing. He was certainly a longtime member of the labor union. I'm sure he believed in the labor movement as he saw it.
Mm-hmm.
I think he compared to some of the other unions that we'll talk about, he saw the union as much more a group of officials like him working on behalf of the workers who didn't really need to be consulted, didn't need to be involved in the decision making. They didn't know what was going on. And so it was much more of a leadership, as he would call it, driven union. And so the workers got these benefits, but to ask them anything about what should be done would have not, I think, crossed someone who was an AFL member like Vandeleur in the 1930s in California's mind.
But he also, as he gained more and more power, it seems he got a little out of control. I'm just saying, he makes wild accusations, calls people communists,
yes,
in court. Yeah. All right, let's read this section a little bit about Vandeleur.
This was a moment when the National Labor Relations Board's holding a hearing. Employer lawyer J. Paul St. Cyr remembered that Vandeleur responded to questions from NLRB attorney John McTernan at a hearing on the Northern California canneries by describing the CIO as a communist organization. Vandeleur asserted that he knew a communist just by looking at the person. If the National Labor Relations Board thought there was a need to investigate representation at a plant and see which union workers might want to have represent them, or if they found there was evidence of an unfair labor practice, which is another part of the Wagner Act that outlaws these list of things called unfair labor practices, usually associated with thwarting efforts by workers to choose their own union, they would hold a hearing. And so there were some plants that the American Federation of Labor had signed up in California, in Santa Clara in particular, and in San Francisco area, and the National Labor Relations Board had a hearing. And so this is a lawyer, John McTernan, who later became famous for being a lawyer for left-wing causes, but at this point he's a lawyer for the National Labor Relations Board, and he is in a hearing with McTernan. And Vandeleur had sort of signed up a bunch of these workers where he dealt directly with the employers. So J. Paul St. Cyr is the lawyer who is helping the employers. And so St. Cyr and McTernan are in this room with the hearing officer. And so we just sort of pick up later. And this is from J. Paul St. Cyr's oral history, which is housed at both Berkeley and UCLA. Vandeleur asserted that he knew a communist just by looking at the person. When McTernan asked Vandeleur if he could see any communist in the room, Vandeleur said, "Yes, I see one. You are a communist." At that point, St. Cyr asked the trial examiner to stop the hearing, since Vandeleur's enthusiasm for pointing out communists had gone too far to be helpful.
You talked in that section a little bit about government attorneys, and you mentioned John McTernan and others. Help us again contextualize the stance of these attorneys. Who were they? And in the same way I think that Vandeleur had a tough row to hoe, they absolutely did too, because they had to dot all their I's and cross their T's or their court cases would be thrown out. And at the same time, in order to do that, it took a lot of manpower and a lot of hours. And it seems like it became, or at least the way you characterize it, overly bureaucratic.
Yeah, so that is one of the conclusions. Some of this research is that the National Labor Relations Board had a difficult time trying to create a process that would allow workers to choose their own unions in the Pacific canneries in a time that would make sense to them, because once they really became involved in the proper legal procedure, one that would stand up in court, the process took so long. By that time, again, in seasonal industry, the workers had gone, or over a number of years, the entire context in which the original attempt to form a union had changed completely. But I think a lot of the lawyers in San Francisco office, to take that as an example, really did, like McTiernan or John Paul Jennings later, really did believe they were trying to let workers choose their own union, but they had this maze of legal procedure and labor law that they had to kind of master and fight through in order to get there.
This is Arts and Letters. We're listening to Charles W. Romney. We'll be back in a moment. I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and this is Arts and Letters. Let's return to historian Charles W. Romney and our discussion about his book, Rights Delayed, The American State and the Defeat of Progressive Unions, 1935 to 1950.
There were many brave women who were also working, and they didn't feel that they were being represented by anyone particularly well.
Yes.
The unions nor the employers.
That's right. So a lot of women in the UCAPAWA, the United Cannery Workers, and there's a great book by Vicky Ruiz called Cannery Lives, Cannery Women, where she really explores this work culture and how women sort of a wide range of ethnic backgrounds and upbringings came together and shared the culture of the canneries and formed a lot of friendships and relationships, but also built these unions from the ground up. So there were a lot of women doing this. And one of the cases that we can talk about a little bit about the struggles that they were having is the case down at what's called Cal Walnut, but the California Walnut plant down in Los Angeles.
When would this have been?
This would have been in the late 1930s, and this was a fight against Cal Walnut to organize. It was led by two women, Luisa Moreno, who is a very important figure for the UCAPAWA and for the labor movement on the West Coast. But she was leading this fight at California Walnut with Dorothy Ray, who was another organizer. And so those two women were trying to organize about 1,300 women who were packing walnuts in Los Angeles. And so they were really, the employers were fighting every step of the way. They were firing anyone who supported the union. They were trying to dispel any unionization efforts. And so Dorothea Ray and Luisa Moreno were gathering pledge cards, were sort of trying to get support, asking the workers to help them to get a vote. The National Labor Relations Board office in Los Angeles investigated this case and found that the company was firing people who supported the union,
right,
organized by Luisa Moreno and Dorothea Ray. And so the National Labor Relations Board sort of had a settlement and won a potential case or got the employers to agree to reinstate some of these workers. But the settlement did not include back pay. So the poor workers were going to lose that time, and they had no money. The union had no money to give them any of those funds. So there were some lawyers in the L.A. office of the National Labor Relations Board, William Walsh, among others, and then Estelle Frankfurter, a woman who worked for the National Labor Relations Board in Washington, D.C., and they were exchanging some memos on this proposed settlement with the California Walnut, the company, and they were worried about this blacklist. And again, in this context, a blacklist is a case where the California Walnut will not employ anybody they think is a member of the union, and they keep a blacklist, so they will exclude any supporters. So the proposed agreement, this is the agreement between the company and the National Labor Relations Board to reinstate these workers who supported the union organized by Luisa Moreno and Dorothea Ray. The proposed agreement did not award back pay to those CIO supporters on the California Walnut blacklist. The CIO opposed it. William Walsh of the NLRB office in Los Angeles described the CEO's stance to the NLRB staff in Washington. Quote, "The union feels that because of the reduced circumstances of the individual involved, because, as they contend, by blacklisting activities of the company, that, as a matter of principle, there should be some provision for back pay." So here he's trying to use a lot of legal language to get back pay for these workers. The fired CIO supporters faced destitution. This is me, not Walsh. Estelle Frankfurter at the NLRB headquarters in Washington echoed Walsh in describing the financial plight of the discharged employees as being, quote, based on the reduced circumstances of the workers growing out of the blacklisting of the company. So here, these workers had really no way to make up for those lost wages. And so the unionization effort led by these women at least agreed to settlement, they would get their jobs back, but there was no provision for them to pay the money back that they had lost. And so here you see the NLRB lawyers working with these women, organizing, try to get a deal for the workers that made sense. And they're very sympathetic that they don't have the funds to just sort of lose 2 or 3 months of work.
Come on, you poor workers, good news to you. I'll tell how the good old union has come in here to dwell. Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
You asked about the women. I would say the California Walnut campaign is a great example of the grassroots, bottom-up nature of some of the UNICAPAWA unions. Luisa Moreno and Dorothy Ray worked with local women. The newspaper of UNICAPAWA ran this great profile, Women Walnut Leaders, you know, which is sort of the women at that plant who were working there, who were leaders of the union. And they won a contract in the end, even though there was this preliminary loss where they had to not get back pay. Ultimately, The workers were given a vote, and they voted overwhelmingly to be represented by the United Yukapawa. And so Dorothea Ray and Luisa Moreno really gave those workers a chance and worked with them locally to let them have a contract, and that contract was much better than any of the conditions they'd had before.
Now all of you know what side you're on, and they'll never keep us down.
It is an Oxford Press book. I'm just wondering, it's a labor of love for you, and I'm just wondering how you did this.
Yeah, so, I'm a historian, so I like to read other people's mail, so especially when they're not alive anymore. So the records I used that were not usually used for this kind of study were the documents of the legal cases and the documents of the National Labor Relations Board. And those are housed.
And are they public?
They're public. You can get them. They're not published. They're right. In the National Archives in College Park, outside Washington, D.C., College Park, Maryland. Case files, thousands and thousands of pages. So legal briefs, transcripts. Vote,
nothing online, though, right?
No. So they're all in boxes. And I'm not the only one who's used these records. I want to exaggerate my originality using them, but not everybody uses them. They're very rich. They're very opaque and difficult to understand. They're organized in a way that's very hard to get the records. There's a whole filing system you have to master that no one knows about to try to get access to them with docket numbers and case numbers and things. But a lot of the research was all over the country, but much of it was in College Park, Maryland, in these case files. And the case files that I looked at, I am certain no one's ever seen before because they weren't doing the Pacific Canneries. So that was a lot of fun. It was great fun to see these records that you know something about and find the story going on in these
records. Were you able to take pictures of them?
I have taken pictures. I've also did some Xerox.
You know, they let you Xerox.
They let you Xerox, yeah. You have to have them look at the folders. So this is the beautiful reading room in College Park, Maryland, where everyone else is sort of looking through these things too.
I came out here from Texas to the state of the Golden West. My pop gets on the WPA because he thought that was the best. They started talking ham and eggs, and that just suited me. I said goodbye to the cotton patch, there's no more spuds to see. We were all so happy and thought we were riding high, but to knock the way out of ham and eggs, and if stay out here, I'll die.
And so let's focus, and those of us who remember our Steinbeck, this becomes, at least in this chapter of your book, a central focus on a microhistory with respect to progressive labor unions.
Yes. So I focus on Local 78. So Local 78 was a member of the United Cannery and Food Processing Workers Union, the Yukapawa. But it really was very autonomous in a lot of ways, and it received some help from the national union. But it was organized and worked on its own, and it had a very tough assignment. It organized lettuce and citrus packers. And so it moved with the workers as they migrated. So the lettuce workers would start in Salinas, Watsonville. They would then move on to the Imperial Valley potentially and move on to other areas, end up in Arizona. And that's what's called the Salt River area of Arizona. And so they would kind of follow the pack. And so these organizers had to follow them as well. And it became difficult for the organizers to deal with the National Labor Relations Board because the government lawyers would say, what's your address? And the organizers would say, depends on the date.
Right.
Because, you know, you've got to go with the workers. So let me just read a little bit about 78. Local 78 sought to organize lettuce workers as they moved from Watsonville and Salinas on the Northern California coast through California's Central Valley and then on to the Imperial Valley near the border with Mexico before ending the packing season in the Salt River area of Arizona. So let's talk a little bit about the citrus workers. So Tulare County is an area that had a lot of history of labor activism and in the 1930s had a lot of citrus packing. It still has quite a few citrus groves. So these are oranges and lemons, different kinds of oranges, Valencias, other kind of navel oranges. And John Steinbeck's novel that we both like a lot.
In Dubious Battle
is set in the same place that I look at Local 78's effort to organized citrus workers. So Steinbeck's story focuses on the part of the production process where people are picking the oranges out in the fields. And I look at Local 78, who was trying to organize when those oranges are picked. They go to a shed, a packing shed, and they were organizing the workers that packed those oranges into crates that were then shipped somewhere else. So Local 78 had tried to organize lettuce workers, and then they were focusing on the citrus workers in Tulare County and Porterville area. And they went to the National Labor Relations Board, and they said, you know, the law doesn't work because you're asking for these pledge cards. And by the time it's only a 6 to 8, 12-week season, and by the time we get the pledge cards signed, the season's over and the employers can stall. And so they said, you know, we have another argument. We think you should just accept our testimony as proof that the workers support us and have the vote during the season so that the workers can enjoy the contract. So if they have a vote early in the season, we can sign a contract right away, and at least the workers will be protected. Otherwise, it's not going to happen for these workers. They'll be unprotected. They'll have to move on. And if we get a contract with this season, then we can have the same contract for the following season. In 1943, Local 78 went beyond its previous arguments and filed a petition asking the NLRB to forego elections entirely and certify the union based on testimony given at a hearing. Local 78 lawyers explained the stakes in a legal brief in January 1944. This is a quotation. If there is to be any collective bargaining for the employees of either of these companies for the next season, there must be certification without an election.
Wow.
So here...
So that's a big deal.
Yeah, Local 78 was saying we don't have time to collect pledge cards to see which union the workers support, but we also don't have time for a vote. We just need to certify so that the workers can have a contract for this packing season. Officials in the San Francisco office and in the NLRB's national office in Washington used Local 78's petition in November 1943 to explore several potential changes to the legal status of pledge cards for citrus workers. So there's a lot of memos discussing what they should do within the San Francisco office. By early 1944, Local 78 and some NLRB officials agreed Local 78 should gain certification for citrus workers by testifying to support for the union at the hearing. So at this moment, the local office doesn't want an election either. It just wants to certify Local 78 without a vote and without a petition. The board in Washington, D.C. did not agree with that in the end. The board decided that they would do something else. They would hold an election based on testimony. So they were going to have a vote. They wouldn't certify the union automatically, as Local 78 asked. But by asking for this change in the way that the board treated citrus workers, Local 78 had caused the national board to change its law and change its rules for seasonal workers, at least for the citrus workers in Tulare County and Porterville. And let me just go back a little bit to Steinbeck's and Dubious Battle that right. We like so much. I think that one of the things that Steinbeck captures in that book is this sense of the rhetoric and momentum a union can build that sometimes gets people carried away. And I think that there's something for that even within the legal system and government lawyers, in that there had been so much time working out this alternative, so much energy given trying to get a solution to this problem. And so they didn't want to give up on it. Even if it didn't work, they wanted to stick with it because they invested so much. And so, and the rhetoric was so great.
Isn't that the problem with all people who create plans? They get invested in the plan and lose sight of if the plan would work.
You need to adjust. You need to make those adjustments, and sometimes you're like, I can't adjust that much.
We made it. Time to get a job.
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 Time to join a union.
Time to join a union.
Time to join a union.
Ain't no stop.
Ain't no stop.
You ain't no stop.
October 1945, finally, what you talk about in the beginning of the book, which is the Wagner Act, it actually reaches fruition. People are able to vote for the union they want to be in real ways.
Yes. So this is the largest group of workers on the Pacific Coast in one contract.
Right. And this is 40 to 60,000.
Yes. A very big group of workers. They had a second election later in 46, and it was the second largest held by the board in its history at that point. So a lot of workers. So this is a great moment for Unikapawa, for organizers, for Local 78, in that this group of workers they considered captive to an illegitimate closed shop of the American Federation of Labor and then the Teamsters, they were allowed to vote and they chose their own union. So this is right afterwards, and Donald Henderson is the president of the union, which was at that point is called the FTA-CIO. It changed its name to the Food, Tobacco, and Agricultural Workers Union.
Time to get a job!
FTA-CIO President Donald Henderson praised the vote in Northern California. In the union's newspaper, Henderson credited the cannery workers for their wise choice. Quote, "The victory of FTA over the attempt of the AFL Teamsters Union to take over the cannery workers is a victory for the cannery workers themselves," he declared, "who have never before had a chance to choose their own union."
Time to join a union.
Here, Henderson's echoing the exact language of the Wagner Act. So he's really believing in the law and the ability to choose your own union. Henderson echoed the legal language of the Wagner Act in his comment by mentioning the right of workers to choose their own representatives. In the same newspaper article, Henderson also predicted the NLRB would certify the FTA in Northern California after it counted a few challenged ballots. And there's some sort of details about how he's going to do that. Henderson displayed the same confidence in a letter to CIO President Philip Murray. He warned of a delay in earning certification from the NLRB because the Teamsters will undoubtedly protest the entire election, he wrote. But Henderson predicted that the NLRB would ultimately certify the FTA. He warned that the FTA would have a tremendous problem of consolidation ahead of us for the next 6 to 8 months of absorbing the union's new members.
We made it!
This would have been a huge victory for the FTA in that it would have greatly added to the number of members. It only had 22,000 under contract in 1941. This would have added 50,000 at least members, so the union would have been much stronger, able to do a lot more.
We made it!
Henderson concluded his letter to Murray by stating that, "It is my judgment that the backbone of the fruit and vegetable processing industry in Northern California is now safely CIO."
Time to get a job!
Time to get a job!
Time to get a job!
The rest of the book is not as happy story. So for the progressive unions anyway. So let's stop right here, though, and you can sort of the golden moment where workers and this union believed in labor law and believed in the government enough that they asked to have the law changed. And they were successful in doing something. Now here, again, they won, but they believed that the workers would choose them and they let them have a secret ballot. So it wasn't as though they forced this union on the workers there. The workers in Northern California did vote for them.
But, you know, no stories are happy, are they? No, this one's that's a happy moment.
It is a good moment for the law at that point. I think it's also just to talk about scholarship and how people do things. I think part of me would have ended the study right there. Mm-hmm. And a lot of labor historians do that, right? Because you kind of want to tell that story of workers having agency and seizing the moment and succeeding in getting what they want. And so up until 1945, that really was the story. Even though there were obstacles, the law was in many ways against them. It took too long. The NLRB attorneys had struggled to do it, but at that point, it seemed like it had worked. But I didn't end there, and there's a lot more where I try to investigate why that union that I had studied that seemed like it was on the top of the world in 1945 was defunct by 1950, 1951.
So last question, Charles. In looking at all of this data and all of this information, where are we now with workers being in charge of their destiny through union?
That's a great question. The goal of the Wagner Act is still the same. It's been amended. There was a series of amendments, the Taft-Hartley Act in 1947. That was the major amendment of the Wagner Act, but there have been some small changes internally with the board since on free speech by employers and other things. But the goal is still the same, still the law of the land, to let workers choose their own union. So I would say the goal is still the same, and the fact that the law, labor law, influences or sort of is around all these decisions in the workplace is still the case in most industries. So we're still in that overall system where workers are struggling to choose their own union. The government is struggling to allow them to do that. But external changes and changes in the workforce are making that more complicated, and it's very difficult in some cases for unions to organize for that reason, because they aren't able to give workers a free choice.
But there is a concern that people will not be represented by unions.
Yes.
And that is represented on the legal end.
Yes, and that's exactly right. I think it's still the case, and it was the case in the 1930s in the Pacific Canneries I study, that the courts have a very important role, for good or ill, in labor relations. And so the Supreme Court ultimately has the jurisdiction over anything that the National Labor Relations Board decides. And it has the ability to rule against some of these public sector contracts. And so the system is still the same in that sense, in that it is embedded in a legal system where we have legal norms and legal procedures, but also where the court can control what happens to this regulatory agency that's been set up to allow workers to choose their own union. You could have the court change that overnight, right? Change what it means to choose your own union, or if your union has been chosen, do you pay dues or not? And I think that part of the system is still there. And so those who are seeking to let workers choose their own union are having to fight that same systemic situation where the law is embedded in everything that workers do.
We made it. We made it. Time to get a job.
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 Time to
You've been listening to Arts and Letters. Thanks for joining us. To check out past episodes, go to artsandlettersradio.org. Thank you to Spencer Kenny for the otherworldly soundscapes. Thank you to Joseph Fuller for the musical compositions and songs. And to Michael Fuller for the voice work on the song Join a Union. Thank you to Mary Ellen Cubitt for the story editing advice. Thank you to the righteous work of Joseph Fuller of An Orchestra of One for helping to mix and master and produce this episode. Generous funding for Arts and Letters was provided by the Arkansas Humanities Council and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Thank you to historian and writer Charles W. Romney for thoughtfully elucidating the complex history of progressive unions and for taking the time to help us understand that rights delayed are not necessarily rights denied. For Arts and Letters, I'm J. Bradley Minnick. Let's heed the words of John Steinbeck. Out of all of this struggle, a good thing is going to grow. That makes it worthwhile. This show is dedicated to Daniel R. Minnick. Arts and Letters is a production of Living the Dream Media.